Hello, everyone. Welcome to our monthly satsang. And our guest this month is John Sherman. And John Sherman, do you want to say hello so that they can hear your voice?
Hello, everybody. This is John Sherman, and I am really pleased to be here with you.
Yeah, good. And could you guys hear John okay? I want to just do a little bit of a sound check before we move on. Yeah, I think they can hear you. All right, good, good. All right. So welcome, John. I don't want to spend a long, long, long time on your story because we only have 90 minutes, and I think that you have more important things to say. I think you probably feel that way too. However, not everyone in the room knows at all who you are, and giving them some frame of reference would be nice. Plus, your story is extremely interesting. Probably could be made into a pretty cool movie, actually. if I'm correct, you were a bank robber?
I was at least a bank robber. I was also a communist revolutionary at the time. I spent some time on the FBI's 10 most wanted list and 18 years in prison. If that's what you're referring to as being an interesting an interesting life, it was certainly interesting.
Well, and you escaped from prison twice, correct?
That's correct.
And one,
that's how I got 10 most wanted list.
Well, pardon my laughter, but yeah, that's quite a character there, John.
It's funny. I laugh too.
All right. So one thing I just want to point out about this before we get started is there are people around, and you're probably aware of this, you've probably met many people who feel very, very, very guilty. And in their lifetime, most of them have not robbed banks. They have not broken out of prison. So I want to ask you, just right off the bat, do you feel guilty for your crimes?
No, I do not.
Can you tell me why?
Well, for one thing, I have pretty much abandoned guilt for all of the things in my life that deserve guilt. And in this case, I don't think that what I was doing then exactly deserves guilt, although I was extremely confused about what was needed and what I should do about it. What I was doing was done actually in probably the most clean and decent things that I've done in my life. So I don't feel guilt about that. I know that it's very plain to me that my understanding of things at the time that led me to those kind of activities was wrong. It was contaminated by what we call the fear of life, which contaminates everybody. And I can see that my understandings and my motivations for what I was doing were not true, not. Well, they were true, but they were not useful as I thought they were. I didn't understand what the actual problem was in those days. I thought the problem was, I thought the problem was capitalism. And, but what I did in those really, newsworthy events, I don't feel any guilt about that. I did the best I could given the circumstances in which I found myself. I had my intent was to be helpful. I never caused, so far as I can tell, I never actually harmed anybody. I didn't blow anybody up. I, caused property damage and things of that nature. So I don't feel guilty. I feel like But most of all, I don't feel guilty because I am extremely aware of what was driving me then that caused me to go out from myself to find a solution to problems that are really, for all of us, have to do with the way in which our minds operate.
Right.
And the problem was different. But it turns out that the people that I thought to be to blame were no more to blame than I am. That all the wrongdoing that happens in the world is done in compliance with the needs of this kind of universal sense that there's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with my life. There's something that's stopping me from being what I should be, stopping me from getting what I should have, stopping me from doing anything other than trying to hide out from all of these things that are out to get me, which are ideas, thoughts, emotions, people, circumstances, you know, whatever the diseased mind can find to throw up as reasons for it. They're all distractions and diversions.
Okay.
So that's guilty of anything.
Yeah, so one of the things you said, well, there are several things you said that I'm going to kind of reiterate, and I'll share my perception. Feel free to correct me. I like to check.
What we're talking about here, I want to say this. What I am trying to talk about here is so different from what I have ever heard that it's very important that I be able to hear from you whether or not what I'm saying is what I'm trying to communicate.
And that's exactly what I want to do. That's why I want to practice these good communication skills. So,
yeah.
So first of all, one of the things you said was that you always had good intentions. You, as far as you know, didn't hurt anybody. But from what I understood in the whole of what you said, that's not why you're not guilty. Even if you had hurt someone.
It's not why I don't feel guilty.
Right.
I don't feel guilty because I don't, not everything I've done in my life has been honorable. It was in the times actually following my first incarceration in McNeil Island Penitentiary, it was in those times that I began to see that I really was accountable for what I did, and I wanted to do the right thing, so to speak. But in the years prior to that, I was a worthless, really worthless human being.
Yeah.
I was a gambler and a womanizer, and I was just a bad person.
Yeah.
But I don't feel guilty about that either. I acknowledge the fact that I am responsible for what I did, but I don't feel guilty about it. I understand very clearly what caused that to play in my own life, in my own mind. So it's not guilt. Responsibility I have, but not guilt.
Yeah, I think this is very mature, obviously, and very important to talk about, because as I mentioned, lots of people feel very guilty much less. And another thing that you said, which I perceive as, you know, just worth talking about for a moment, is that you were operating based on, I think you might have used the word polluted. I don't remember what word you used. What contaminated?
Maybe.
A contaminated point of view. And you said you were wrong. But the fact that you were wrong doesn't make you guilty either, right?
No. No. If guilt is an extremely useless state to find yourself in, it is a symptom of the disease. It's entirely a symptom of the disease, and it does no good whatsoever except to cause you to hate yourself or to push the blame for what you've done on somebody else or to just go crazy. You know, guilt has never in the entire history of the species guilt has never had a good effect whatsoever. There's, you know, responsibility doesn't, the sense of responsibility does not come from guilt. It comes from the absence of guilt and the absence of all the things that I came to believe to be what it was to be a human being. And it turns out that none of those things are true. It's all aspects of the fear. We are all under the goad of the fear for most of us from the moment of birth. And in fact, I have a piece that is out, and it might be useful to you and your listeners to look at. And it's called "No One Is to Blame." There's no one to blame for any of it. Not for all of the murder and the horror that's going on in the world now. Not for any of it. No one's to blame. Every single individual human being who acts in destructive, self-destructive, or destructive to others or to anything, acts in those manners, does so not because they're bad people, but because they're infected with this disease, which we call the fear of life.
Okay, so why don't we, I know what you mean by the fear of life, because I've been spending hours listening to you, but that doesn't mean that everybody else here does. So why don't we go to, first of all, you mentioned a while ago that guilt is the symptom of the disease. Is the disease fear of life?
The disease is the fear of life, that's right.
Okay, why don't you talk about that?
Well, and again, I'm just going to say as a intro to this, that this came to Carla and I over what is now 17 years of which began with us as spiritual teachers, and that wasn't satisfying because it was very plain to me that what I was saying had nothing whatsoever really to do with what had happened to me. And it took us the first 6 years of our time together to realize that the whole model of kind of pseudo-spirituality was not going to, would not hold what we were seeing and would not serve what we were seeing in any way that was useful at all. So after about 6 years of being a spiritual teacher, we stopped that. And for another 6 years, we stopped actually having meetings with people, directly with people, pretty much, you know, every once in a while, but very seldom. Because during those years, we were trying to come to a clear enough understanding with ourselves as to what it is that we're seeing, because it's not something for which there's any model, right? It's really not. And in the last 6 years, we've been consolidating that and coming to a clearer understanding of it in a way to speak of it that's useful, so that now we are actively trying to get out. And the reason that I was so happy to your invitation was because I really want to speak to people about it.
Okay.
And here's what we see to be the case, what I see to be the case. Carla, too, but I'm talking to you, and I'm responsible for what I'm saying. What I see to be the case is that pretty much all human beings, there are exceptions, I'm sure, but pretty much all human beings are infected at an early age with a sense that there's something wrong with life, that life is dangerous, it's not to be trusted, and this comes at such an early age that even those concepts aren't able to hold what actually is being experienced. What's being experienced is the sense that there's something wrong here. There's something wrong that I have to do something about. And I look around for things within my mind, for things to do about it, and the mind, which itself is the diseased organ of this whole thing, comes back with ideas and thoughts and that are consistent with the idea that life isn't worth living, that life is dangerous and untrustworthy and fearful. So that's what happens. We think that it's quite likely that this happens for most of us in the birth trunk. That's really quite likely, you know, when you think about what birth's like for most of us, not for everybody, but for most of us, it's a harrowing and terrible experience, I'm sure. But whether it's the birth trauma or not is beside the point. What's plain is that pretty much everybody has this what we call a psychological autoimmune disease. Autoimmune disease is that which tries to protect you from something that you don't need protecting for.
Right. Well, I agree with you. I've just never heard it expressed that way. The way I word it is that the mind is trying to tell us that it's our savior.
That's right. I have found that it's not very useful to anthropomorphize these things.
Now, what does that big word mean?
Make the mind into something that's doing something with intent and agency. Right?
Yes.
Because that's not what's happening. There's no agency there at all. The only place where there's agency is in your ability to attend to what you choose to attend to, and that agency is mostly crippled by the disease.
All right, I understand.
Our attention is drawn to things that are bright and shiny or dark and ugly. Bright and shiny, this might be good, and dark and ugly, you got to stay away from this. But it's all false. There's nothing going on at all except thought forms arising with mood things that are trying to keep you safe when you're caught in this trap of being alive. That's really the heart and soul of it.
Yeah.
You're caught in this trap of being alive. And there's nothing you can do about that. Well, actually, many people do something about that. The cause of death of most people under 30 is suicide. Mm. And that's just statistical fact. So that in some cases, the fear drives us to actually check in and get out of this horror show that we find ourselves in. So that's what we see to be the problem. And we don't think that everybody is affected by it, and we don't think that everybody is still sick. But the vast majority of the 7 billion of us here on this planet are diseased with this disease.
Okay, and tell me if this is true also, because, you know, I'm looking at myself as I'm listening to you, looking back into my history, and I don't argue that I didn't have the disease, but I don't think I was consciously aware of it.
Of course not.
Yes.
No, that's part of the disease.
Yes.
there's no spot that you could go to that would make you think, oh, wait a minute, this isn't me. This is a disease that's causing me to think these things and want these things and not want those other things. There's nothing about it at all that is available to anybody to suspect that might be the case. It's either there's something wrong with me because I'm a bad person, in whatever way I'm a bad person. There's something wrong with you because you're a bad person, in whatever way I think you are. Or there's something wrong with life because it is crushing me
in
the
way
that it is.
Yeah.
Now, that's what we see to be the problem. It turns out, and let me see how I can go here. It turns out that the cure for this disease is extremely easy, that there really is almost nothing to it. But the cure for this disease has been stumbled upon in the past, in the distant past, by those who were intent on solving the problem who had nothing but the best motivations for solving the problem, but were not in a time of our development, the human species development, when this could even have been considered, that it's a psychological disease. So it took on, naturally, metaphysical consequences, metaphysical circumstances, as the cause and the cure for the disease. Now, there are...
Now, can I pause for a second? I want to check an understanding. So when you're saying it took on a metaphysical, is this behind that statement? So therefore, in a way, it put the problem out in a realm that a person feels they cannot reach?
Well, it does that, but you see, the one, let's talk about Ramana for a minute.
Okay, sure.
Everybody's a Ramana, all right? And Ramana is one of my heroes.
Mine too. Here he is, and he's all over, but here's one.
Yeah. Although he was wrong.
Huh?
But, although he was wrong.
Yes. Okay.
But Ramana, and I'm not going to go into a long story about Ramana, about his death experience and his death of his father and all that stuff, because that's just available to everybody, right? Mm-hmm. But Ramana, because of things that happened in his life, actually did what we are asking everybody to do, which is to get a taste of what it feels like to be him. And he did that in an extreme circumstance.
Yes.
In which he tried to pretend that he was dying. And in the inner work that he was doing and trying to accomplish that, he touched himself. And everything changed for him. Everything. He didn't know what happened. He was like 16 years old at the time. And he didn't know what happened. But he, after a couple of years, he ran away to the temple in Tiruvannamalai to find out what had happened to him. This is why he's such a great example of what I'm talking about. And the way what he found out about what had happened to him was from the thousands of years of work on the whole business of that ends up with self-inquiry out of Vichara. So that's what he decided happened. And it was natural that he would think that. He spent several years in the temples and several more years walking around in the caves of the mountain there. I don't remember the mountain, Arunachala. And ended up in the ashram was and ended up actually
yes.
built around his cave at yes. one point and because of his mother's arrival. But the thing is, that's just story. But the thing is that Ramana taught everyone that they had to move their attention to their own self. And the only thing he knew about self, because of his education in the temple, was that it was a mystical and metaphysical thing. Self is everything. It is, all the things that the spiritual effort thinks about self and God and all the and the rest of it. So he had kind of confused himself to the point where he could not be of much use to anybody because it takes extreme and enormous effort to try to, in the effort to try to find self, it takes enormous effort to actually touch the reality of what it is to be you consciously while you're looking for something godlike, which is self, which is everything, which is the entirety of everything. So those, and he was just the latest of, I mean, not exactly the latest, but in the latest group of true gurus speaking in the tradition of the Upanishads and self-inquiry. occurred to him when these things came into being in the first place, this idea about Atmavichara came into being in the first place, it was a time when we assumed that the world was flat. That's how little we knew about anything. And it was natural that things that were seemed so important and so important both in positive as well as negative ways must have something to do with some godlike or spiritual force that was operating in the universe. And you never look back. You know, I mean, these guys had managed to free themselves of the disease without ever knowing what the disease was or what actually was happening, and there was no point for them to ever look back. So.
Okay, can I ask you a question? Or am I interrupting?
please interrupt, because I want to be understood. I don't want to.
Okay, so I'm trying to think of the best way to ask the question, because as you know, words get in the way, and I don't want the words to get in the way. So if you'll do your best to listen to my intention of the question. So my question, I guess, is do you either believe in or have the experience of anything at all beyond the person, or do you think, as my dad says, we're born, we live, we die, that's it?
I honestly don't know how to answer that question. I have an experience of life that that I assume to be physical. All right? However, the fact is that whether it's me, you, or anybody else, the only place where I have that experience of physical life is in my mind. There's no other place that it appears. As I'm talking to you and hearing your voice and hearing my voice, that's happening in my mind. As I look at my finger here, as I'm waving it around, that I'm feeling and seeing in my mind. Yeah. If I scratch my knee, that itch and that scratch is experienced only in my mind. So, I am convinced that this is a physical experience. I'm convinced that this is a physical life that I'm living. And I'm convinced that this physical life will at some point depart. And there will be nothing left of me, except floating in the nether regions. But I don't know that. Nothing that would make me feel comfortable in saying that there is nothing spiritual about anything. I know nothing that would make me feel comfortable in saying that there is no God, for example.
Okay.
There's nothing about anything I know that answers those questions.
All right. So
what I do know is that in whatever form I am here. And that the experience of being here in this world is entirely mundane and physical. Whether it is actually physical or not is beside the point. The experience of it is physical and mundane. And that's good enough for me. The idea that I need to have complete comprehensive understanding of the entire universe and existence itself has departed, has left the building for me. I'm in love with my life. I truly love being alive. I truly love being a human being. I love washing the dishes. I love cooking. I love speaking here with you. I love music. I love all of those things. All of those things that human beings love that are not tainted, the love not being tainted, I love. I like washing the dishes. Maybe I said that already.
You did, but that's good. We like men especially who love washing the dishes so much they mention it twice.
I like doing things, you know, and I like seeing through something. I like understanding something that I haven't understood before. But none of that is metaphysical in my mind. I mean, except, of course, my mind is only a mind, and I have no idea what it is. But none of that is what I would call metaphysical. It's all ordinary human life. And it's hard. Sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it's easy. Sometimes it's painful. Sometimes it's sweet. There's no time when I think that I am being tricked by my life. There's no time when I think that my life is not worth living. There's no time that I think that what really would make me feel good is if I never had pain, or if I never had confusion, or if I never had anybody contending with me.
All right, so if I'm hearing you correctly, it's not that all experiences for you are good the way the mind would label good. It's just that you have gotten to the point where you can enjoy all experiences.
Right, but and not enjoy all experiences. I don't enjoy being sick, right?
Okay.
I had a one of those, what kind of virus is that? Neurovirus?
It was like...
But it was food poisoning.
Oh, I had that too.
It was the worst. I have never, you know, I've been shot and all kinds of things. But that was the worst pain, the worst misery that I have ever experienced in my life. But, and I certainly was in great pain.
Yes.
But I wasn't, crippled by it.
You weren't hating life, I would assume, correct? You weren't hating life because of this experience.
No, not at all. And what happens is, and you would have to have known me for a long time to know how really outrageous this is. What happens is that for me, things that are problems like that pain, right, it's just something for me to understand to the extent that I can understand it that might help me do something about it that would be useful and not make it worse.
Yeah.
And that's the same with everything that comes to me now. Everything is something to be understood, and not understood in a spiritual way, understood in a, a hands-on, bare-bones way.
Yeah.
To be understood, problems are come that need to be understood, need to be dealt with. Good things come that need to be understood and need to be related to. And all of that is this, happens within this magnificent theater that is being human, this humanity, this theater, me, human. It all happens in that. And I am the only thing in that entire plan that has any agency whatsoever. Everything that happens, all the psychological mechanisms, whether good or bad, they're all algorithms. That's all they are. They're algorithms. And everything that happens in my life is something that interests me. And it neither saves me or damns me. It's just life as it is.
Yes.
And it doesn't take away the pain. It doesn't make you so that you are, floating high all the time or, I'm cool. Nothing happening here. A lot is happening here. And all of it is welcome. And all of it is satisfying. Even the pain is satisfying and well worth experiencing.
All right. So, again, to sum it up, maybe this would be correct. You have come to a point where you love being human.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And there's a lot of things that come with being human, but you love being human. So let's, this is nice because this tells people, I think, kind of where you are. This sets the stage. But what we haven't talked about is how you got from the fear of life and trying to fix it and all the ways you tried to fix it to loving being human. So why don't you go into that a little bit?
Uh, I'm hesitating because how it came to me is it might be a kind of interesting story, right? It began in prison, right? And it took a long time for it to bear fruit. But it might be easier and more useful, you tell me, to just tell you what we have come to understand about what can be done with everybody based on what has happened to Carla and I.
Sure, let's do that.
What we have seen, what we've come to see, and this is based on our own experience. I'm not telling you the story. I will later if you want me to, but I'm not going to tell you the story about my wrestling match with this.
Well, let me just say, if people want to hear John's full story, you can listen to his Bat Gap interview, Buddha at the Gas Pump.
Maybe. I don't remember what I said then.
Yeah.
I wasn't through. I wasn't,
okay.
You know, here's the thing. There's two things here, right? One is me coming to the point where I'm no longer afraid of my own life.
Yeah.
Right? That happened pretty early on. The other is trying to figure out how that happened and trying to find a way to speak to people about it. And in the Buddha at the Gas Pump interview, I don't remember exactly what happened there, but I was still very much in the state of trying to understand how to communicate this. And I still had the kind of cobwebs of spiritual understanding hanging on me, and I couldn't quite speak about things with the clarity that I can now.
Okay.
I'm not all that clear now, but I'm clearer than I was then.
Okay, well, so what I will say is that in about the first hour of that, you told your story. So if people want to hear your story in great detail, they could listen to the first hour, and then when you start talking beyond that, they could turn off saying, you know, I'd rather listen to him more recently.
That's a great. That's a good point. So, here's what we've come to see. And I want to say that this is not something that we've come to see like sitting here talking to ourselves or meditating about it or anything of the kind. We have come to see this, I have come to see this, as a result of going on 12 years of trying to find a way to speak clearly about what it is that happened to me and communicate it to other people so that it could be useful to them. And so this is not just dropped from the sky, you know. So what we've come to see, and this again is based on our own experience, first of all, and a growing body of really several thousands of people who have embarked on this journey also, and have, many of them have come back and become parts, members of our forums, and that has taught us a great deal. We've seen how the things that we see about this are true, and we've seen the things that we see about this are not true. They need to be reevaluated. So what I'm about to tell you is to a certain extent a work in progress, but not what I would tell this to anybody, and I don't think I'm going to change much of what I have to say now. We might get a little better at, you know, finding ways to communicate it, but right now this is where we are, and we're not going to go much further from that. We believe, and also, by the way, you can tell your listeners this too, there is a paper written by some psychologists and posted in a psychological journal called The Radical Act, which also talks about this from the point of view of psychotherapy and so forth.
Okay.
So this is what we see. Any person, any human being, whoever they are, if they have not either won the lottery by not ever catching the disease, this autoimmune disease, everybody else, you can pretty much figure that their minds are contaminated with this disease. Contaminated is not the best word, but you know, damaged by this disease. So, what we found out, and this came, it began because of the way that it happened to me in prison, because of the way that it happened to me in an effort to debunk the whole spirituality while I was in prison, and to debunk Ramana in particular, his self-inquiry. When I was in prison, in that state, I had the opportunity and got an actual taste of me, what it feels like to be me. So that's where I started. What we've come to see, and again, with many, several thousands of people who, and probably more than that, because people don't always report back because of the way, nature of the unfolding of the cure. Anybody, doesn't matter who it is, Donald Trump, anybody, you know, the president, the ISIS, anybody, really, yes. Anybody.
Yes, anybody.
Will take a serious effort to see if it's possible to get a taste, just a feel of what it actually feels like to be me. Mm-hmm. By it's the personal pronoun, me, not me, you.
Well, let me just ask a couple questions, because of course we want everything to be as clear as possible, and as you know, words can be understood differently.
Right.
So when you say me, and of course we're each talking about our own me, let's assume that I am a person who has depression right now. I would assume that if I think the depression is me, that's not what you're referring to.
No.
Okay, so can you explain what me?
You are symptoms of the disease.
Yes.
A whole array of things that you think about yourself, and some of them may be true, most of them are false, but they are all symptoms of the disease and the way they're deployed. So the me I'm talking about is the actual bare bones feeling of what it is to feel like you without anything else. Now, that feeling, that sensation, it is a sensation. It's nothing spiritual, it's just a sensation. And that sensation is extremely faint. There's not much to you, really. It's extremely faint. But as it turns out, faint or not, and even whether you believe you have done it or do not believe you have done it, it is impossible for you to fail. Since what you're looking for is you, what you would call me, since that's what you're looking for, it would be absurd to even to believe that you could fail. You can fail to believe that you've done that. Now, that's part of that. That could be part of the disease structure.
Going back, listening to that mind again.
Yeah, right. You can believe you didn't do it. There's all kinds of beliefs that can come about, but in my humble opinion, and this has enough confirmation from others to make me confident of it myself, continue to be confident of it myself, you can't fail. If you try with your whole heart, to try to get a taste of what it feels like to be you, you will do it. Whether you notice it, because it's very faint, whether you notice it or don't notice it, if you try, you can't fail. You really can't. And there is also, and this is just, you know, it's a matter of just stopping what you're doing for a moment, probably sitting down, getting at ease, you know, getting settled down. It's probably difficult to do it if you were in an agitated state. You know, you would succeed, but it would be much harder for you to know that happened. Mm-hmm. And most people find it easier to close their eyes. And close your eyes and just begin to try to get find somewhere some sensation, some faint sensation that when tasting is clearly what it feels like to be you.
Yeah. Well, I know the sensation. I do. but I don't know for sure if everyone listening does. And one of the videos I saw of you recently, you kind of led through a little exercise to kind of help people maybe accidentally discover it. Do you mind doing that for us?
In fact, I'd be happy to do it.
Okay, so...
I just said a moment ago. It's not a big deal.
Well, but you did a little more. You did something like paying attention to the foot first, right? Kind of a little pre-training, so... Yeah.
Okay, so here's what you do. And everybody who's listening and wants to do this, just stop for a second and kind of settle down. And if you're seated, just sit there. Most people find it easier to close their eyes. And I think that's a useful thing. So just stop for a second. Let things settle down, whatever's going to settle down. Notice the fact that you notice the feel of your breath as it comes in and out of your body. That's a good way to stabilize yourself. You just, as the breath goes across the nostrils on the way out, and across the nostrils on the way in, just pay attention to that. Try to keep your attention on your breath for a moment. There'll be a lot of thoughts and sensations and so forth that are calling out for your attention, but you need not attend to them. Just sit there for one moment. Get rested. Follow your breath for a moment. And then notice that what you are doing when you are following your breath is putting your attention on the feel of the knot of the breath as it crosses the nostrils. It's your attention that is bringing that experience to you. Now you notice that your attention, that you actually can move your attention elsewhere. You can move it away from your breath. You can move it back to your breath. As soon as you are clear on the fact that you do have the ability to determine what you attend to, although it can be very hard, you do have that ability. Turn your attention inward. I say inward, whatever that means. Turn your attention inward and see if you cannot taste a very faint sensation that you will immediately recognize to be you, although your mind might deny it. You'll recognize it, you can't mistake it. It's very small. Now, if you do that, if you did that, then you have done really all you need to do to be confident that within the next within the next few months, that everything will change. Your relationship with your life will change. You may find, here's what usually happens. After you've just done this, and I'm assuming everybody here has done it, what you most likely will experience is either later on today or tomorrow, you'll begin to feel like everything's pretty cool. Like there's not much happening that's bad. Like you're just calm. And that will persist for a while. You'll find that the things that worried you before aren't worrying you now. The worry might be there, but you don't care that much about it. You'll find that things are kind of smooth. And that'll go on for a while. Could be a week, a month, a couple of months. A couple months is probably more than you can expect it to continue. After a short time, and this is important for you to understand, after a short time, a week or two, something on the line, you will suddenly feel like things had gotten worse than they ever were. That the stupidest thing you ever did was do what I asked you to do here today. That everything is terrible. All of the things that you had kind of under control are no longer under control. And this is not, this is, has proven to be the case always in now thousands of people. We call this, we've come to call this, as I told you, we think of this disease as a psychological autoimmune disease. They're trying to protect you from life because something has caused the context of your psychology to be afraid of life. So, but this happens. It's called the recovery period. We've come to see that this is a recovery period, just like the recovery period of any disease, or many diseases have periods of recovery in which things are worse than they were when you started. And that's what's going on here, is the recovery period. You can expect that to happen. And if you've done the looking today, as I've asked you to do, you can be pretty sure that that's going to happen. So don't be caught by surprise by it.
Well, and in fact, I was thinking of your food poisoning, actually mine, because I had food poisoning 2 weeks ago. So I was thinking of our food poisoning. And, you know, at first, at least in my case, I started feeling what felt like a lump in the belly. It wasn't that bad at the very beginning, right? But you knew right away there's something wrong. And then, of course, it starts getting worse and worse. And eventually, in my case, there was throwing up and diarrhea. And sometimes, oh, no, which one do I have to do the most? Because you can't do both at the same time very, very neatly anyway. But all of that throwing up and all of that diarrhea, which was the most uncomfortable part of the illness, is what led to the recovery.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right. Good point. I hadn't seen that before. But yes, that's right. That was necessary in order for you to recover.
Yes.
It's the same with this, except it usually takes longer than the 3 days. Or But here's the thing, and this is something that is, if anything, even more important than the cure that is the looking and, you know, and how you're going to, your life is going to get better. Your experience of life is going to get better. The recovery period will pass, and if you have not stayed like with us, like in the forums or something, we know that there, and in fact, now we have people coming to us for whom this has all been true. They have done it and went through the recovery, and by the time they got through the recovery, which for me it took very long, many years, but now it takes maybe a year at the most, right? So that when they get through the recovery, and I think it can get down to 5 months, when they get through the recovery, they have forgotten all about what happened before, and they just, you know, go into their lives in sanity and self-reliance. And of course, we never hear of them. But we have heard of numerous people now in that category of people who did it and went through the recovery and so forth without bothering to tell us about it. We're having people come back now, you know, like 3-4 years after, telling us that what we said was exactly what happened. And that they have gone through the recovery. The recovery was as we said it would be. And they have come out the other end and are sane and real human beings.
Yeah.
So we have an enormous amount of evidence that is consistent, always consistent. And we try very hard not to, shape the things that are going into the forums. We try to let people do what they will and only interfere to encourage them or really, when people are really confused, I will try to straighten them out a little bit so that they have a little easier time. So we have an enormous amount of evidence to the fact that the course that I just described actually is what happens to people that do this act of looking. It's actually what happens. Now, what we found in a lot of it has been confirmed in the forums and with other people. What we have found is that people who do this looking, once they get to the recovery period, which means once they get to the period when everything goes upside down again, once they get to the recovery period, there is an actual practice that is incredibly effective, not only in mitigating some of the misery of the recovery, but also in informing and educating the mind as to the actual nature of itself and what can be done, what cannot be done. And this is a practice that some people confuse with mindfulness meditation. It's not mindfulness meditation. You know, mindfulness meditation and I'm speaking now, I don't have much to say about late modern spiritual ideas, but when I'm talking about mindfulness meditation, I'm talking about Tibetan Buddhist mindfulness meditation.
And you practiced that in prison, correct?
Right, I did.
Yes.
Took 47 vows. I'm wondering now whether that was a mistake. But mindfulness meditation in Tibetan Buddhism, in the Mahayana tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, is designed in order to deal with the assumption, the understanding, that life is suffering.
Yes.
That's the bottom line insight in Tibetan Mahayana Buddhism. Life is suffering. That's what it is to be alive, is to suffer. So the mindfulness meditation of Mahayana Buddhism is to bring people to a practice in which they accept everything as it comes. They learn how not to turn away from misery, but rather to stay, let it be there, to not try to escape from misery, but just to stay there. And this is, they do this out of their determination to be compassionate, because they know that human life is misery.
Yeah.
It is suffering. So, and they also know that the acceptance of that will make for an easier time of anybody who's able to accept that life just sucks.
So they aren't just being still until the misery ends itself. Nope. They're literally holding on to it in some way.
Right. They're learning how to live in a life that is miserable.
Oh.
That's the nature of Tibetan Buddhist mindfulness meditation. Now, you know, all of the modern dance routines that have come out of it, I don't know much of anything about. But that's what Tibetan Buddhist mindfulness meditation is. What we are offering people, and really, and everybody is listening to this, you should really pay attention to this.
Okay, ding, 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 pay attention, everyone.
if you've done the looking, you're going to be very happy if you pay attention. One thing we've come to see is that there's only one thing at all that we have anything to say about. There's only one thing. Everything else just happens. I'm waving my hand in the air here, right? And that's just happened. I think I can stop it. Maybe I can stop it. But it's just happening. I didn't start it. I didn't deliberately start it from happening. I don't deliberately start anything from happening. But there it is. It's happening. I'm talking. I'm yakking away with you and so forth and so on. I don't have anything to say about that. The algorithms of the mind, and my mind is healthier than most, and certainly healthier than it's ever been, the algorithms of the mind happened without my saying anything about it. I have nothing to say about it. I have nothing to say about the algorithms that come that make my personality, that make my person, actually. The only thing I have anything to say about is what I attend to. That's it.
Yes.
There's no other, there is free will, but that's the only place it happens, is what I attend to. And it turns out that I actually can choose what I attend to. And that is so magnificent, once you see from when it comes, that it just blows you away. My God, I can determine for myself. Because we're not used to thinking that. Our attention goes to what calls it.
Yes.
Really.
Yes.
But that's the disease. The disease has taken control over attention so that we don't harm ourselves by refusing to attend to what the disease knows to be things we need to attend to. And of course, these are just algorithms. I personalize them as if they were at agency, and they don't either, right? They're just... But that, and here's the thing. The other thing about attention is that attention is where the energy comes for all of the mind's activities. It's attention that energizes it. If you attend to anything, that gives it energy. That's how it's fed. Yes. That's exactly how it's fed. So, having seen that, we also have come to see that it's better to decline to attend to the remaining soldiers of fear that are still mucking around in your mind, trying to, for God's sake, don't you know what you're doing, woman? Get back here. You're going to kill yourself. So we urge everybody, and I have to say I haven't been very successful at having this be adopted by everybody, mostly because of the way the mind unfolds and so forth. But anybody who will begin as early as possible to learn and strengthen their control over what they attend to will go through the recovery period not with misery and heartache and wishing it were over, but as a circumstance that gives them the opportunity to become skillful in the only thing they can do, which is to decide what deserves their attention and what does not deserve their attention. So that what we offer, what we ask people to do, as soon as they can, you know, but surely when they begin to go through recovery, is to start a practice. And the practice is this. You start by just sitting down, being comfortable. You don't have to keep your eyes open. You don't have to close your eyes. Just be comfortable enough that you're not being, called by discomfort and pain away from what you're trying to do. So just sit there and relax for a moment. And then, and most people find it easier to close their eyes because there's distractions, visual distractions. And then, again, using the breath, using the out-breath and the in-breath, the way in which the feeling of the out-breath as it crosses the nostrils and the in-breath as it comes in. And we advise that the out-breath is the best place to do the counting. It just seems to be better. So you stop, you sit there, you relax, and then you start counting your breath. And what your goal is to count the out-breaths to get to 10. Now, you can take my word for it or not, but for almost everybody, and for me certainly, it was a long time before I could get past one.
Without you paying attention to probably the mind or something else.
And not me paying attention, without attention being drawn by some train that's running in the background, being managed, no doubt, by the agents of the fear. And you find yourself, you sit there, you get all ready, you find yourself, and then, okay, one. And then, oh, and then there's this, oh, and then there's that, and then, and pretty soon, God knows how long you've been, but you know, the time will come when you, and when it dawns on you, oh, wait a minute, hold it, I'm supposed to be doing this. And then what you do then is you start over again.
Yes.
Whether you miss it one or you miss it nine, you start over again and keep counting. And it doesn't take very long to get skillful and strong with this.
Yes.
It really doesn't. It's much easier than it sounds when you first start doing it.
Well, it sounds
like what it does is give you, it gives you, it returns to you the control over your own attention.
Yes.
You get to decide for yourself what you're going to attend to and what you're not going to attend to. And as it turns out, in recovery, the recovery is an excellent kind of sandbox for this, because in the recovery, all kinds of things are calling for your attention. All kinds of miseries and confusions and desires and aversions and so forth. But you, when you've mastered control over your attention, you see that happening and you simply decline to attend to it. You move your attention away from it.
So,
and every time you do that, you are starving whatever algorithm it is that's causing you to do that. So they fall away.
Yeah.
And not only does it minimize the recovery period, but it gives you clarity and confidence in your ability to manage your own life with the use of your attention. So,
well, and I just want to say, you know, because I think people can hear in a confused way, what you just described is very different than repressing feelings.
Hell, very different.
You're still allowing the feelings to be there. You're just turning your attention to the breathing or...
The breathing is neutral.
Yeah.
And the thing is that you just decline to attend to it. And
right.
What happens is that weakens it.
Yes.
And it doesn't take too long for you to begin to see what's happening as a result of what you're doing there. Because things start clearing up. You know, if you don't attend to that, and you don't attend to that one thing for a couple of times, it starves to death. And it just dies. It doesn't come back. These things are not, have no agency. There's no, personality there.
Right.
They're just algorithms. And you can kill them off by not feeding them.
Yeah.
And so there.
Yeah. It's very, very simple. And I appreciate it. And sometimes I tell people, just in my teaching, I tell people, what you are is a caster of attention. And I hear you saying the same thing with different words. And so now let me ask you a question about the looking, because we just practiced the looking once. Do you have any recommendations at all about how frequently people should practice the looking? Does more time practicing the looking benefit more than less time?
No. So far as I can see, and like we have a really long history with this now, so far as I can see, it makes no difference whether you continue doing it or don't continue doing it. It's not it itself, the experience of you is, there's not much to it. It's very faint, it's not much to it. But what I've seen, what I've noticed, what I noticed in myself, and I've noticed in other people, is that it's not uncommon for you to find yourself doing it again. And that's fine, it can't hurt you. It can only, be good for you. There's nothing bad about it. And I did that. I found that after accomplishing that finally, that I would find myself looking for it again. It's kind of a little sweet thing, too. So it's not, it's something that... But it's there's no need. This is a one-shot thing. If you take the vaccine, you're going to be cured. if you look at yourself, which is taking the vaccine, you're going to be cured. It's going to be over with. It may be a long, hard road, or it may be a road that is punctuated with a growing self-reliant understanding of your relationship to your mind and to your life. But you're not going to, but whether it's long or short, hard or soft, the end is going to be the same. You're going to find yourself a human being yearning for nothing. Really, yearning goes away. Yearning for nothing, with great satisfaction in all of the things that you are doing, you know, like just doing, not thinking about, but doing, no matter how mundane they might be. You'll find great satisfaction in learning how to do jobs better. You'll find great satisfaction in just being alive and the wonder of being alive and having the ability to witness this amazing, wild reality of existence here. But without thinking that that means anything. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
You mean something. Nothing of what you experience and love and hate or whatever, that doesn't have any meaning. That's just the unfolding of the existence over time. It doesn't mean anything. Or at least I don't think it does. I think it's much more intelligent to say it doesn't mean than to say it does mean, because when you say it does mean, then you're off on some trek to get something, some meaning from it. It has no meaning. The only thing that has meaning is you. That's all there is that has meaning. You. And that meaning is served by curing yourself from this terrible disease and taking self-reliant action to understand and learn how to be better at being the human being that you already are. How to be more effective at being the human being that you already are. How to be more open to receiving everything that comes. To notice when there are still vestiges of that fear, and to decline to attend to them, toss them in the dustbin of history. And that life, and this is the life that Karin and I lead, that life is like nothing I ever imagined. No amount of fame, fortune, spiritual success, nothing can match the experience of a human life sanely lived, really, in my view.
All right, so one of the things that you commented on briefly at the beginning is, because I called you a spiritual teacher. Actually, this was before we came into the room. I commented that you were a spiritual teacher and you said you were not, so they probably didn't hear that. But from what I understand, the reason that you do not call yourself a spiritual teacher is because you're not adding spiritual beliefs to your direct experience. Is that true?
Yes, I suppose that's true enough. I mean, it's not the only reason, but that's part of the reason. It's just because I see nothing there that's of any use. The what was of use has passed, and what we are, when those men were sitting around the campfire in northern India, like thousands of years ago, making the Upanishads, understanding what they saw to be the nature of existence and so forth. That was the time when the misguided idea of spirituality actually did something useful. It wasn't spirituality that made them sane if they became sane. If they became sane, it was in spite of spirituality. And that's true of Ramana also. He became sane in spite of spirituality. Became sane before he became spiritual.
Right.
And I see nothing in, and I'm not, and let me be really clear on this. I have nothing to say about what anybody else sees. I have no I don't advise people not to have a spiritual practice. I don't advise them to have a spiritual practice. The only thing I advise people to do is to cure this disease.
Yeah.
And know that the cure of the disease has nothing to do with spirituality. It has to do with their ability to determine for themselves what they attend to. And that's true from the very beginning, from the first law. And so that, to me, spirituality, in whatever form it takes, with whatever significance it might have, is beside the point. It's just beside the point. The point to me is human being, and we are desperately in need of getting free of this terrible disease. We have brought ourselves to, once again, to the brink of destruction. And we've been doing this like every 100 years or so for a very long time. And each time we come to a point where the possibility of lethality for all of us is bigger and more likely. And so I'm not so much interested in caring about spirituality one way or the other. My interest is in bringing this possibility of sanity to human beings without regard to whether they have a spiritual practice or not, without regard to whether they're religious or not. I don't care about that. I'm not telling people not to do that. What I'm telling people is to do this.
Yes.
It doesn't preclude that. If what you're doing in a spiritual vein serves you truly as you go through the recovery and come out the other end, what do I care about that? I want you sane. I don't care whether your sanity includes spirituality or not. That's beside the point to me. I want you sane. I want humanity to be sane. And because we are something.
I have a question. It is kind of a spiritual question, but I'm just curious about your answer. The teaching that you teach is not new to me. I won't even go about how I discovered it. That's irrelevant. But I understand the teaching very much, and I do the looking. And I do the looking in a couple of different ways. I do the looking just in every day. And I also do the looking in meditation. I sit and close my eyes and look. And that's what meditation is to me. So I do the looking both ways. And I understand some of the experiences that come about from the looking. Now here comes the spiritual teaching, which I don't know for a fact yet from my own direct experience. The spiritual teaching is if you keep looking and keep looking at at some point, you could say that you even bust through the human consciousness to a greater consciousness. I don't know. The only way to find out is to do it. I don't know the answer to that question. But my question to you is, do you see any value in continuing to look? Or at some point, are you just satisfied and the looking has stopped?
There's no need to look more than once. There simply is no need. It's such a pleasant thing that it can be, people can want to do it. But in my case, I have no interest in it at all. I know I'm here. I don't need to refresh my memory of that. And I know that the looking is more like a vaccine than anything else. What's happening really is in the mind. That's where everything is happening. And I know that I have control over my attention. Mm-hmm. I'm very clear on that, which wasn't the case all my life. I know that I have control over my attention. I have seen firsthand that by using my attention intelligently and deliberately, that I can increase my intelligence and the way in which I handle and manage my life. My intelligence increases because of that, and I know that to be the case.
Okay.
Really, it's really quite stunning, actually. Most of the stupidity comes from the smothering of the agents of fear that smothers the mind. I don't remember exactly what the question was.
Well, the question was about continuing the looking until you expand into, till you become more than the human consciousness.
I don't know. I don't know if there's more to us than meets the eye.
Yes, that's what it's about, yes. And you don't know.
And I don't care.
And you don't care.
I don't know if there's more to us than meets the eye. What I know, I don't know that. What I do know is that human life is deeply satisfying in a way that is unimaginable in a mind that has not rid itself of the disease and come to a strong understanding and practice with their own attention. I know that. Everything else, and I know that I really love being alive. I'm very happy with being alive. And there's nothing that comes up that makes me feel like, oh, wow, I wish I was a godlike creature or something. That never happens.
Yeah, that never happens to me either. I think more for me, there's what I would call a healthy curiosity. But nothing about wanting to be a godlike creature.
my curiosity tends to go into science rather than...
Oh, yeah. Mine definitely does not go into science.
Did you know, for example, that there is now a project in play where they are going to try to actually send an iPhone to Alpha Centauri to get the true feel of it, they are developing a huge array of lasers, right, to be deployed in an open desert area. And then they will put this iPhone, they say iPhone, they might be using that as a metaphor, but they're going to put this iPhone in orbit around the Earth, and then with a spectacularly precise timing, they're going to have all those lasers blast that iPhone, and which will accelerate that iPhone, break it away from the Earth's orbit, and accelerate it to 600,000 miles an hour in the first 2 seconds. That will bring it to Alpha Centauri in 20 years.
Wow.
Really kind of.
So what I'm learning about you is you're not only an ex-bank robber, but you are a current geek.
I am that too. Personally, my biggest claim is that I am sane.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And in fact, one thing I want to say about you, because I'm looking at you on video and everybody else only has you on audio, I do want to say that there's happiness, peace and love in your eyes, and at certain times in the conversation when you were saying certain things, the love especially would expand, you know, like the happiness and the peace is always there, but when you're saying certain things, the love became very intense, and I saw every bit of that, and that is worth something, whether my dad is right, you're born, you live, and then you die, or whether the spiritual teachers are right, there is more. Either way, most humans have not gotten to where you are right now. So it's worth listening and worth taking the advice. And then if people feel to expand further and they want to listen to those teachings, which I do very much in my heart, that's great too. If they want to pay attention to science, that's great too. But getting to sanity, I think you're correct. Is important.
First go sane.
First go sane, and then do what you want. That sounds like good advice to me.
Yeah. That's my advice.
Yeah.
And what I have is the way to go sane, which is new to the world,
really. Yeah. Does Carla want to add anything? We have 5 minutes. I know she's over there in the background.
Say something? No? Sure. Say hello. You can say hello.
I can say hello to everybody. No, today I'm just watching.
Yeah, just watching. Well, it's just so everybody knows.
I enjoyed this conversation very, very much, and I'm very happy to meet you and see you and hear you and watch our interaction, the two of you here. It's been wonderful to sit here, right here, and watch. Thank you.
You're welcome. And as I mentioned, I will send you guys the audio tomorrow, and if you feel it's useful to share it anyway, it will be yours as well. I want to thank you very much, John, for saying yes. We only have 4 minutes left. Why don't we do the housekeeping details? If anybody wants to learn more about you, where do they go? That kind of thing. Carla can do that.
We have a free ebook that's called No More Fear, No More Anxiety. It's a little ebook, and it has all the things that John talked about, the fear of life, the recovery, the exercise, the practice of attention. It's called self-directed attention. It's all there explained. So you go to justonelook.org, and right there on the homepage, you'll see a link. It's in many other areas of the website, but the homepage is the easiest. So you just click and download it and take a look, and you can refer back to it to remember the exercise and all of that. And we do have an online open house. It's a webinar on April 24th, that's Sunday, next Sunday, at 2 p.m. Pacific time. So if you're interested, you need to register. It's free, but you need to register to get the link to sign on. And if you don't have a computer, you can register and listen and call in and listen to it on the phone, too. There's numbers all over the world, too. And that, if you go to justonelook.org/events, or just go to the homepage and look on the menu for events, you'll find the link to the page to register there. And then you get all the information. I hope some of you come, and if you have questions, you can come to the webinar and ask your questions directly to John.
Yeah, thank you.
I think that's it for now.
There you go. We got her to talk. there was one question on the board, but you know what? I think I can answer the question. But it's just one look, not just one book. Justonelook.org. Yeah. And here's the question, but I think I know. I'm going to pretend like I'm you and answer it, and you tell me if I answered correctly for you. I just want to make sure I get you. So the question is, aren't we all godlike creatures? And my John answer is, I don't know, and I don't care.
<It's me. laughs>
Okay, then I get you then. All right. Well, thank you very much, sir. This has been a pleasure.
Oh, I thank you for the opportunity to talk to you and the people that are here with you. It's a great pleasure to me and useful to me. So.
All right, wonderful. Thank you. And I will, as I said, I'll be in touch with you tomorrow. Goodbye, Carla.
Bye.
Bye, John. Bye. It was nice meeting both of you.
Thank you. Thanks, my body.